Hey everybody, welcome to podcast number 3 of Podcasting Them Softly. Nick and I are going to be talking about Star 80 this week, which is one of my favorite films made by Bob Fosse, who's one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. And we also saw, both of us, not together, saw in theaters this weekend, Ex Machina. Neither one of us know how to pronounce it. So I had to go to the Merriam-Webster website and listen to it pronounced. Hang on. Machina. Ex Machina.
There you
that's
go.
What Merriam, that's what the lady robot voice from Merriam-Webster said. So I don't know. I thought it was Ex Machina, like a female machine, but I was way off and we looked up what it meant. And anyway, so we both saw that. We both, I would say, what, loved it?
Yeah, my initial response is certainly of overwhelming admiration. It'll definitely be one of those movies where I look forward to seeing it again and seeing certain scenes again to see how they play out again. But yeah, on first glance, definitely excellent. You know, heady science fiction, you know, something that's interested in ideas and, you know, character and rather than just empty special effects, which is always, you know, always nice and refreshing.
Right. Yeah. I remember I saw it before you did. I saw it Saturday morning and I remember I just sent you a message right after I got out of it. And I think it was just like, yes.
Yeah.
And for me, science fiction is difficult because I love the genre, but it's very rare for me that I can find a sci-fi movie that I love that has a grand idea and closes it well. I think most science fiction movies don't have an ending that suits the idea, but this film, I loved it. It to me, it was a fuse between Blade Runner and The Island of Dr. Moreau, where you have this isolated setting with four characters, and you have Oscar Isaac, who's this genius. He made a search engine he essentially created Google, right?
Yeah.
He created Google when he was like 13, or he wrote the code for it when he was 13. And he is what, in his almost 40, I don't know how old Oscar Isaac is, but I'd imagine he's supposed to be in his mid to late 30s in the film. Essentially what he does is he creates AI, the first AI per this movie. And it's walking, it's living, it's breathing, and he has Domhnall Gleeson, right? That's his name?
Yeah, Brendan Gleeson's son.
Brendan Gleeson's son. Both of them are going to be in Star Wars, which was another huge reason why I was excited to see this movie, the new Star Wars movie. And Oscar Isaac brings Gleeson to his compound, this weird little, I don't know, it's almost like a bunker. It's like a bunker, right?
Was it in Alaska?
I imagine so. It's like somewhere like rural and beautiful.
And with also glaciers that you could observe the pollution. I love the little, did you notice the subtle, my dad pointed out to me, I'll give him the credit for that. The pollution ring on the ice, but that was a subtle little touch, but nice. But yeah, I get the impression that it was Alaska, you know, somewhere within the United States because he's American. He's a British actor with an American accent, so they never tell you where he's from, right?
I think he's from New York.
New York. Oh, yeah, that's right. They say
Staten Island.
Yeah, they say Staten Island. Yep. So he's in New York, and Isaac is living out in the middle of nowhere alone in his little compound. Yeah.
And Isaac brings Gleeson there, and Gleeson works for Isaac's company, and he brings Gleeson there to test his new AI and to see if it passes the test where Gleeson can't really tell if the AI is or begins to forget that it's AI and it's actually human. And the film's broken down into what, like, quote unquote, 7 sessions with Ava.
Yes.
Which is the AI. And the movie just frantically builds to this isolation and paranoia to where you don't know what the character's motivations are. to where in one scene you think Oscar Isaac's the bad guy, and then three scenes later you think the AI is the bad guy. And it just kind of blends everything together, and I really loved it. And I felt very claustrophobic watching it, and I felt like paranoia while I was watching it. I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed Oscar Isaac. That guy has just been hitting it hard lately. I can't think of anything that I've seen him in where I wasn't like, wow, this guy is incredible.
I definitely agree. I said to my dad when we left that he, for me, he's basically like another Tom Hardy. He's a guy that he changes his look in every movie. To think that Oscar Isaac,
the shaved head and the big bushy beard in this movie, I loved it.
To go from Llewellyn Davis to Abel in Most Violent Year, and then to this, and then and other things before Inside Llewellyn Davis. He's great. He's got that chameleon quality that you love in great character actors, and the taste in projects, much like Tom Hardy, is very, you know, it's pretty much impeccable. He's only interested really in making good films with good filmmakers and testing himself as an actor. And yeah, you know, I wasn't surprised so much to be blown away by him because he's been so good of late. Alicia Vikander's performance, I believe that's how you say her last name. Fantastic performance.
Yeah, and she was incredible.
Just incredible. And it's such a deceptive role, and we don't want to spoil anything on this for people who haven't seen it yet, but it's tricky. Every character has multiple motivations, reasons for doing things, and the way that the narrative is set up, you never kind of know who's playing who, quote unquote, and some of your expectations that you bring into the theater, I think, will be subverted. I certainly felt mine were. And like you said, the ending, a lot of times science fiction films, they can bite off a little bit more than they're able to fully process and chew, and they get bogged down in too much and a battle and, you know, crazy special effects. And, you know, the special effects in this movie were flawless to my eye. And
yeah, they were. It was incredible. It didn't look phony or CGI at all.
And it served the story, and it was used in a way to propel the narrative rather than just to lurch it forward. And this movie couldn't have cost a lot of money because it's quote unquote. This is another A. You know, I thought this was interesting. This was an A24 production, the same company that put out Under the Skin and The Rover and Spring Breakers, and some of the more recent, very interesting movies coming out, you know. But this one had the backing of Universal International or something. I noticed the Universal logo in front. So that this one's going to have, I think, a better reach with people for that young company. A24 also produced While We're Young, the movie I saw last week. So they've got their hands in quality, and they want to work with interesting filmmakers, it's clear. This is the kind of movie that I feel that if more people knew about, it would be an even bigger hit than it is. It's turning out to be a nice, solid hit, but it would be even a bigger hit if they could just get it out there a little bit more, spend a little bit of money on some ads. I mean, I live in Connecticut. You live in Chicago. Have you seen much advertising for this movie in Chicago?
I haven't seen anything for it. I generally don't watch too much television, so I didn't see any TV spots for it or anything, but I hadn't seen any press or anything like that.
It's another one that
flew under the radar.
Yep, it'll be another one of those movies that'll find a passionate audience, I feel, and the people who go and see it. And, you know, for those who take a chance, you know, those people that go to the theater just to see a movie, I think that some people will be surprised. And then I think that at the end of the day, there'll be a lot of people who will be like, nah, that, you know, I didn't like that. It didn't do it for me, but for this viewer, definitely cool stuff. And I don't want to spoil the movie or Under the Skin, but I could not help but feel, especially towards, and I know you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, not yet. I'll watch it this week.
The last 15 minutes of Ex Machina definitely, for me, spiritually and thematically ties into the beginning of Under the Skin. And after you see Under the Skin, maybe we'll circle back and we can talk about how the two films complement each other. While one movie is about artificial intelligence and one movie is about an alien intelligence, from another planet. They both deal in some of the same themes, and it's a good time for science fiction. I mean, you've got your big budget stuff coming out, which does look exciting with Star Wars, and then you've got this smaller stuff like this film and a movie from earlier this week, earlier this year, that I'll throw a quick plug for is a movie called Spring, which I think I've talked to you about, but I don't think you've seen.
Correct.
And that was another sort of interesting science fiction film with a little bit of a horror bent, but then also sort of a romance thrown in there, but a film that was constantly switching it up on me and wasn't expecting where it went with it, with the story. And it had some very clever and very well-used special effects instead of just smothering the whole thing. It's a good time for science fiction. There's some really good stuff on the horizon, I think, coming out. Hopefully they all have sort of a good ending, like you said, because it is tough to nail an ending to a sci-fi movie.
Well, I know Star Wars well, so we're good there.
Well, you know, at least for them, they've got what? Like, how many movies are mapped out? So,
three of the new trilogy plus a bunch of standalones, so they'll be good. I mean, Oscar Isaac's going to be in it. He's leading the fucking new X-Wings. He's like the hotshot rebel pilot. It's going to be awesome.
Very cool. And
he's going to be the Apocalypse in the next X-Men film, which is excellent.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. It's like, at the end of the last X-Men movie, I was kind of like, all right, I've seen enough X-Men stuff, but then I hear that...
Really?
Yeah, just for me personally, just, you know, like...
I thought Days of Future Past was fantastic.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was fun. For me, the X-Men movies kind of feel like they cover the same ground every time.
X-Men are awesome.
I liked, to be honest, the First Class. Was that what it was? Matthew Vaughn's movie?
Really?
I really liked that one because of the tone and because of the setting.
It was a James Bond movie.
Yeah, that's why I liked it. I thought it was cool. It was like a warm-up for Kingsman, which was
I thought insane. First Class was good, but it felt like it was half-assed because it was originally supposed to be an origin film about Magneto, where Goyer wrote it, and then they turned it into an origin of both Magneto and Professor X, and I felt like the McAvoy stuff with Professor X was lacking to where Fassbender's storyline of being this badass Nazi hunter was just incredible. I loved it.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen a standalone Magneto movie with that. Yeah. Well, again, I don't. We've had this conversation, you know, outside of the podcast. We could probably cover Marvel and, you know, comic book movies in general for, you know, an hour itself. But
right. I know where you're going with this. Like, I could give a fuck about Marvel. I don't care for the new Marvel movies. I just don't give a shit about them. Whatever. I'll see the Avengers because I like James Spader and it seems something very special they did with Ultron. But whatever. I mean, but keep in mind that Marvel isn't doing the X-Men films. And I thought Days of Future Past was very dark and adult-oriented. And I think that's something that the Marvel Universe is lacking, essentially. The Disney Marvel Universe is lacking, I should say.
Yeah, I guess I should watch it again. Because when I saw it in the theater last summer, I just kind of sat there and I enjoyed what I was watching in the moment. But it just felt to me like another run through of the X-Men, but maybe I should give
it. And then you got the fucking Dink. Peter Dinklage is the bad guy. And he's this little mutated midget and he hates mutants because they have mutant powers and his mutation makes him short and he fucking wants to kill them all. It's awesome.
Yeah, it was good. I'll have to watch it again. I think I even own it and I haven't even put it on since I got it.
At least we didn't get into another Star Wars fight this time.
No,
so.
No Star Wars fight this time. But why don't we switch? Just because I know that we do like the comic book stuff when we're talking DC stuff a lot.
And, goddamn right, we do.
And why don't we just quickly talk about the reveal of Jared Leto as the Joker in David Ayer's upcoming Suicide Squad?
What's fucking awesome.
Okay, yeah.
Dude, it broke and I just couldn't even believe it. I saw it and I was thinking to myself that if you're going to redo the Joker after Heath Ledger redid him what, how long ago is that? 6 years ago? I can't remember how long it's been.
Yeah, I mean, for leisure.
It was intense, man. It was super intense. And I know I told you this, but I really fucking hope that Suicide Squad's rated R. I doubt it'll happen.
Me too.
But it better be a hard PG-13.
David Ayer does not make movies for wimps. He has never once made a movie that, you know, has been anything less than, a quote-unquote a guy's movie. It would be unprecedented outside of Watchmen and the lower budgeted Punisher movies to have an R-rated comic book movie. I would certainly love it, but something tells me that the budget and the crossover into the rest of the DC world, which will be PG-13, as one would imagine. Yeah, it'll just prohibit, because it's like, you can't make an R with one thing and then, like, what, lessen the impact in another.
Because you know the Joker's going to cross over into the gigantic Justice League.
You're getting a movie about villains. So right off the bat, it's going to be dark. It's going to be different. It's going to be cool. It's going to be something that we really haven't seen yet. I'm just racking my brain as we talk. I'm trying to think about a movie specifically about villains. And I can't really think of any. Can you? I mean, I really am racking my brain.
The only thing I could think of would be like, Dirty Dozen, but they weren't necessarily villains. They were all guys that got in trouble had to perform a mission. I mean, that's to me what Suicide Squad sounds like. I didn't know what Suicide Squad was.
Neither did I.
And then I looked it up, and I thought it sounded really fucking cool, man.
Mm-hmm. Me too. It has a lot of potential, and I like the cast. My first response too was the same thing. Jack Nicholson comes in and does his iconic version of the Joker, and then Heath Ledger comes in and does not copy Jack Nicholson in the slightest and does his iconic version of the Joker. And we haven't heard Jared Leto speak. We haven't seen any footage from the movie, but just from the visual, you are left with the impression that this is going to be a completely different Joker than what we just saw with Ledger. And they're going to do what they really smartly need to do, is they need to do different things. I mean, if you're going to show us the same character over and over again, make it different, make it exciting, give me something new. And that's what it appears to be here. And it appears to be in keeping with the realistic, sort of dark and, downtrodden mood that Nolan kicked off with his trilogy, in which, Zack Snyder partially brought to Man of Steel. This new one looks, by nature, sequels are darker. You can tell that this one's going to be, you can tell this is going to be one of the darker superhero movies that gets made. I just have this feeling.
So, I just got three words for you, bro. Chewie, we're home.
Fine.
All right. Anyway, no, I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. I agree with you 100%. Whatever.
We'll talk further about it when we see it. So we see a trailer and we get to see more. So, why don't you introduce our featured movie for the week? Because I know that it was something that you turned me on to.
Goddamn right. This week, we are going to be discussing Star 80, which was Bob Fosse's final film. Little background on Bob Fosse. He's one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. He originally started on Broadway and was a Broadway filmmaker. He was a Broadway director. He brought the revival of Chicago onto Broadway, which was probably the biggest thing he did on Broadway, on stage. And then he crossed over to film and did Cabaret, which I have yet to see, and I know that's bad because that's a film most people have seen, yet I haven't. I own it, though, so there's the first step. Fosse won Best Director over Coppola for Cabaret, I want to say, for the Oscars. Well, Godfather swept everything, but Fosse won Director. Think I'm right? And Joel Grey won Best Supporting Actor.
Yep.
Liza Minnelli won Best Actress. Anyway, and then he went on, he made Lenny, the film about Lenny Bruce with Dustin Hoffman, which is excellent. Then in 1979, Fosse made my all-time favorite film, All That Jazz, which is still the best film I've ever seen. And I revisit that film all the time. I know you just watched that today, which was awesome. And then his final film was Star 80, which is a tough film to watch, man. I mean, it is rough.
It's a gut punch.
What the film is about is it tells the story of Dorothy Stratton, who was a Playboy playmate, and how she was – it essentially shows her life and her naivete towards men, I guess you could say.
To the world and men, yeah.
To the world, and how she was completely taken advantage of. And her life was essentially taken over by Paul Snyder, who, quote-unquote, discovered her at a Dairy Queen in Vancouver, who is played by Eric Roberts, and he eventually kills her, which we didn't spoil anything by saying that because you know from the opening scene of the film what happens.
And it's a true story rooted in, you know, reality, much like I couldn't help but see the parallels to last year's Foxcatcher in a lot of ways, just sort of the inevitability of impending death. And I know that
I never thought of that or put that together. But when you told me that right after you watched Star 80, I couldn't help but agree with you. I think those two films are very similar. And I like how you put it, impending doom or sudden death.
Yeah.
That it's like this manifest destiny of this is what happened. I don't know. It's a scary film because it's the inescapability.
It's just you.
Perfect.
You know that this terrible thing is going to happen, and you know the way that he cleanly tells the story. And what I mean by that is just he doesn't get bogged down in too much. Other than what you need in this particular story to tell it. There's really not one wasted scene. There's no superfluous moments.
Zero filler.
Zero. And the framing device of the movie, with having the faux interview style, where people are being, you know, they're being asked about Paul and Dorothy and the relationship and those interviews and the information from those interviews are sort of guiding the story along. You know, that was awesome. And I don't know at the time, there was probably other movies that did that, but I don't know how many were doing that.
He did that with Lenny.
Well, yeah, with Lenny. I'm just trying to think about if it was super popular the way that, you know, nonlinear storytelling got, you know, so popular within the last 20 years. You know, it's like every movie or TV show is told in some, you know, some sort of, you know, extra fashion. I really enjoyed the way that it was structured. And it sort of reminded me of Bernie, another movie about a
right.
real life crime that Richard Linklater did. Super underrated. I don't know if you've seen it. I forget. You know, we talk a lot about
it. I have. Yeah. I loved it.
Yep. And, you know,
I liked how I liked how Nolan used that Interstellar as well, where he opens the film with the documentaries or the.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The,
yeah. And I
the recounts.
Yeah, I was just watching Interstellar last night, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's interesting how Fosse frames this film. Mariel Hemingway, who plays Dorothy Stratton to a T, I don't know if you know what Dorothy Stratton looked like in real life, but I mean, Mariel Hemingway is dead on. And the story is about her. She's the star, essentially. She gets top billing, but it's told through not Eric Roberts' character's point of view, but I think I would say he's definitely the main character.
Yeah, definitely.
I think he's the lead, even though it follows Dorothy's life. You're following Dorothy's life through Paul Snyder's perspective.
Yeah, and through his ultimate manipulation of her as a person. I mean, once they meet and once their orbits collide, if you will, there's no helping her. I mean, almost every decision that she makes as a person up to a certain point is dictated and guided by Paul Snyder. And
even the other male characters in the film, Cliff Robertson plays Hugh Hefner, which I think he does a fascinating job. He doesn't necessarily look like Hugh Hefner, but I believe it's Hugh Hefner when I'm watching the film. I always like Cliff Robertson too, so
me too.
That helps. But you kind of see how Hugh Hefner manipulates her in a way where he really doesn't care about her. He just wants to sell her tits in a magazine and stuff like that. And then Roger Rees plays the fictionalized Peter Bogdanovich, who Dorothy Stratton made a film with. And I almost think he's as bad as Snyder is, the way he's portrayed in the film. He's more subtle with his approach. He's not over the top and dramatic, but he's definitely conniving. I mean, did you get that feeling too, or did you think he actually cared about her?
No, I got the impression that he was it's interesting that they use Hugh Hefner's name, right? And as far as
right.
I
can, and Hugh Hefner actually sued.
Yeah, he was pissed and sued, and they didn't what? They just figured we can't use Bogdanovich's name because he'll really sue us because the I don't know.
I don't know what the deal is. Here's the thing, though, and I have a hard time trying to find the validity of it, but there's this rumored love triangle that happened in real life between Bob Fosse, Dorothy Stratton, and Hugh Hefner. And I don't know if it's true or not. I've tried to research it online and stuff like that. I can't find anything with Fosse in interviews or Fosse talking about it. But I know that Fosse and Hefner were friends at one point in Fosse's life, and I don't know if this Dorothy Stratton thing kind of they definitely weren't friends after the film. I mean, that goes without saying. But I don't know if in a way this was Fosse taking a shot at Hugh Hefner by keeping him in the film as opposed to taking Bogdanovich's name out of the film. Because I would imagine that Hugh Hefner would hold more pull and have more clout than Peter Bogdanovich, because at that point, Peter Bogdanovich wasn't doing anything, and he really hasn't since.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's interesting. I would have to imagine that both Hefner and Bogdanovich were not impressed with how they were portrayed. Bogdanovich is, you know, how he's portrayed through that fake filmmaker is of a guy who's blown away by someone's external beauty and basically wants to keep her as a pet. And at least that's how I saw it for the most part. I mean, maybe he did love her. We know you never know what happens between two people. But when you are... See, it's the movie also makes a lot of comments about beauty and about the female image and the form and the body and about how men instinctively respond to overwhelming beauty and how overwhelming beauty can just be too much for some people, which clearly was a major problem for this Paul Snyder guy. I mean, this guy had multiple issues, but one of the issues was that after he did what he wanted to do, which was to get this lady found and discovered and make her a star, he starts to realize, yeah, this woman is a fox and guys do want to sleep with her and I'm going to be challenged at every point. And those are the things that he wasn't thinking about when he just walked into that Dairy Queen and saw this gorgeous woman.
Do you think that's it, or do you think that Snyder wanted to be famous?
Oh, well,
and Snyder wanted to wanted to propel himself with her. Like, he gets the license plate Star 80 on their car with the money that she brought in.
He was ready to use her name to open a thing at gyms.
What, nightclubs or something? Yeah, gyms. That's what it was.
And Bogdanovich is like, you know, don't do it. It's going to, you know, like, we don't want to have your name on a gym. And no, I agree with you there. The false sense of superiority and the sort of... you know, there's a quality actually to this movie that also is shared with Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, in that people are so people are so deluded into thinking that they're a star and they should be famous when they have no, you know, no reason to be famous. They don't have any talent. They're just a schmuck who either gets lucky or, you know, does something, you know, bad or transgressive to make them famous. You know, all of those two movies sort of feed into the, you know, emergence of reality television and making people a star for, you know, utter stupidity like a Kardashian or something. So it's a deceptively layered film, because you're sort of just like, it's a cut and dry crime film. This guy is, you know, he finds this woman, he kills her, you know, his mental unraveling and everything. But when you boil it down under the surface, the movie is exploring multiple things.
A terrifying aspect of this film is, due to the fact that it's told through Paul Snyder's perspective, is the fact that you can begin to identify with him towards the end of the film, where everything unravels and he just becomes this emotional ball that has just lost control of his pet, so to speak.
Yep.
Dorothy. It's terrifying, because I watch the film and I watch Eric Roberts and you start to identify with him, and it just makes you feel uneasy and uncomfortable. And it's a lot like, in a way, Taxi Driver, where, well, they're two different films, but I do, like, when I watch Taxi Driver, I feel uncomfortable and uneasy,
mm-hmm.
because I identify with Travis Bickle. It's like, I don't want to identify with Travis Bickle, but Scorsese gives you no choice to.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like with Fosse. Fosse gives, I mean, you can identify with Dory, or with Dorothy, and stuff like that. That's fine. But you get put into these situations throughout the film, Star 80, where Fosse is just essentially making you identify with Paul Snyder, and it's terrible.
Yeah, and it's one of those things too that you know, we were talking before about how Fosse's work, you know, obviously inspired multiple filmmakers, but a clear influence, at least that I felt, was on, you know, Boogie Nights and on Paul Thomas Anderson, and sort of the comparisons between aspects of Paul Snyder to Dirk Diggler's character, the visual reference of him in the mirror flexing, and Paul Snyder
right.
flexing, that I just have to believe that that's Paul Thomas Anderson giving a shout out to the movie, and maybe there was another inspiration as well for that bit towards the beginning of Boogie Nights. But there was just a lot of stuff that felt the Snyder character is so clearly Eric Roberts' best performance, and we're going to get into his top five. But and I probably gave away my top pick there, but. It's a sensational performance, and he's playing this guy that just towards the last half hour of the movie is unraveling at such a rate, and the last 15 minutes are stomach churning.
Oh, like, it's terrible.
Like the moment
watching...
she walks into his, it's when she goes to his place right at the end.
Yeah, she goes to their house where she wants to
awful.
Sign the
and
get
you
him
just,
to sign the divorce papers.
And you just watch him, and he's just the movements he makes, and the eye with the eye contact, and just a truly unnerving piece of acting. And I was 3 years old when this movie came out, so and I've just seen it last week for the first time, so it's not like I. You know, I didn't grow up with Eric Roberts per se. You know, I sort of came to him after he had done some of his really iconic work. To see him that young and thin and with the mustache, and just if that performance comes out now, he gets nominated for an Oscar. How is that?
Oh, goddamn right.
Oh, and again, I hate to always use the Oscar as the mark of greatness.
As a barometer, right.
Yeah, but that's what we do in this society. How does that performance not win every award the year that it comes out? You know,
I know it's bullshit. At least the Golden Globes nominated him.
At least,
I mean, that doesn't say much.
No.
But like, at the very least, at least the Globes nominated him. I can't believe, because, well, also take into consideration that Fosse kind of... You know, he kind of thumbed everybody's nose and everything, especially Hollywood and stuff like that, especially with all that jazz. But at the same time, all that jazz was nominated up the ass for everything.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know. I don't know what the deal was with that. It's incredible, because you're watching Eric Roberts in this film, and the first two acts of the film, he's like this over-the-top, campy sleazeball.
Yeah, he's like the pimp.
It's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Right, and it's enjoyable on like this somewhat comedic comedic way.
Yeah.
But then the third act of the film comes where he takes this complete turn into this terrifying person, and you're just like, oh, fuck. But throughout the entire film, Fosse's reminding you what Snyder is. Through the opening scene takes place after the murder, where he's covered in blood, and he's very Iago-esque from Othello, where the film's told with these cut-ins of the end of the film, where Snyder's covered in blood, and he's talking to himself, and he's giving these like little soliloquies of his inner feelings, and he's just spitting them out, and it's just a very vicious and raw performance. I can't say enough about it. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like it. It's a unique and one-of-a-kind performance by Roberts. And the guy gets a lot of shit, which we'll get into later when we cover his top five performances. But he's become like that guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's in TV shows. He's in straight-to-DVDs and straight-to-VOD. He's that guy.
Yeah,
which
he certainly has come to be that guy. I mean, I was blown away, and I guess if you want to, you want to segue into maybe his, unless you want to say anything more about Star 80 in general.
Yeah, just real quick. I should have covered it earlier, but essentially, what the film's about is narcissism, which is what Fosse's films are generally about. All that jazz, Lenny, narcissism, and the price you pay for it. I think that's his major theme.
Absolutely,
the dark side of celebrity. Or fame, what fame does to people, what celebrity does to people. Lenny, all that jazz and Star 80 encompass that greatly.
Absolutely, and literally starting this podcast on the almost immediately on the heels of finishing all that jazz, you're totally right. I mean, Fosse was clearly a guy who had a bitter angle to him, and he was a guy that had a cynical edge, and he wanted everybody to know it, and he didn't really care.
Bob Fosse could give zero fucks.
Exactly. So
that's why I love him as a filmmaker, because he doesn't give a fuck and he's not going to shy away from anything.
And it's amazing because in the three, because I've seen bits and pieces of Cabaret. I have popped it in the Netflix queue and I will be seeing it soon. I've seen Lenny. I've seen now All That Jazz and obviously Star 80, and the influences that this man had through three movies. They just feel very wide. It feels to me that so many filmmakers, Scorsese, Paul Thomas Anderson, I'm sure you could make a list of it. It feels like he was just an incredibly influential filmmaker who only made four movies. And I wanted to throw this one out there too. Scorsese's movie Casino, which turns 20 this year, which I still can't believe is hitting 20th anniversary. The Lester Diamond character, James Woods, playing the pimp who, you know, discovers Sharon Stone, if you will. While that is a subplot, of the film, the Lester Diamond character, Paul Snyder and Lester Diamond were basically brothers. I mean, I don't know if, I mean, I know that the...
I agree with you. I think,
Lester Diamond was the Lester Diamond character, whether or not that was his real name, you know, these movies are based on real people.
Right.
My guess is that Scorsese just might have said, hey, let's Paul Snyder up this role a bit. I don't know.
We'll get James Woods to play him, because James Woods always plays the fucking sleazy guy.
Of course.
It's
of course.
Awesome.
And who
it's
better
perfect.
To play a sleazy pimp in 1990, you know, shooting that movie in 94, who better to play a sleazy pimp? So I just couldn't help but feel that there was some sort of like indirect correlation, visual inspiration for the two pimp characters. But
they have the sleazy mustache,
the sleazy
70s clothes. It's
exactly.
Perfect.
Manipulating people, talking to them, you know, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, you know, the whole thing. So absolutely. I just Star 80 really surprised me. It was just one of those films. I feel like I've basically been the last month. I feel like I've just been watching one movie after another that slipped by me for whatever reason as I was growing up, and I'm just getting a chance to see all this great stuff, and this one was no exception, I think, you know, why don't you kick it off with your Eric Roberts?
Yeah, we're going to do our two actors this week that we're doing the top five performances of is Eric Roberts and Ellen Barkin. And we're going to start with Eric Roberts, and we're actually going to go in descending order this time, which we will from now on. I don't know why we didn't do that before. I guess I just thought of a top five list, like top 10 list, where you just name the first one. But anyway, I guess this builds more suspense. My number five for Eric Roberts is a tie. You've done a couple, or you've done one tie, almost
yeah, we'll
two ties. So I figure I'll do a tie. My first one for number five is the Cable Guy, mm-hmm. his cameo in Cable Guy. And I had to put that in there because I love the Cable Guy. And that's my favorite part of the movie is the Eric Roberts cameo where he plays Sam and Stan Sweet on the TV movie. It's perfect on so many levels because Eric Roberts is that guy that would star in that TV movie. And then it's just this total riff on his Star 80 performance, which makes it even more genius on so many levels that Ben Stiller would include that into his film.
Yeah,
it's absolutely hilarious.
Makes me love that movie even more.
Right. And I quote my two friends and I, we quote Eric Roberts from the Cable Guy to each other all the time. Like, you're such a crybaby and all that shit. It's just, I love it. My second number five is The Dark Knight. His small performances, Salvatore Moroni, the mob boss that takes over from Tom Wilkinson from the first film. The reason I like him so much in The Dark Knight is because he's so subtle good. He's low-key. He's just gives a very calm yet commanding performance, and I think it's interesting because Eric Roberts is definitely over the top and overacts in most everything I've ever seen him in, including Star 80 and the films he's most well known for. He's always over the top and out of control, and I love the fact that Nolan used him in such a low-key role like this, and I think it's interesting that Nolan picked Eric Roberts over James Gandolfini and Bob Hoskins, who both were lobbying for the part. I just think that's fascinating that you imagine being like James Gandolfini or Bob Hoskins and Christopher Nolan being like, oh, I'm going to go with Eric Roberts on this one. And then just being like, what the fuck? Because even in the comics, Salvatore Moroni looks like James Gandolfini. He's like this big mob guy.
Yep.
But anyway, those are my two number five, or my number fives. My number four was... I don't know if you've seen the television show Oz, but that's one of my favorite shows. It was HBO's first show they ever did, and it was essentially the first cable show. It took place in a prison. I'm sure a lot of people have seen it. I love it.
I watched Oz.
In the fourth episode of the first season, Eric Roberts plays an inmate on death row, and he only has two scenes in it. But in the course of the show, in the fourth episode of the first season, capital punishment's brought back into California, and one of the characters from the show is going to be the first inmate executed in the state of California in like 30-some years. And Eric Roberts plays the guy that's in the cell next to him, and he's this hillbilly from down south that's this serial rapist and murderer, and he's just so disgusting and out of control in it. It's just, it's awesome. It's another low key performance. He's not larger than life like he normally is, but I love the fact that he was in Oz. I think it gave the show a little bit of validity because that's still when Eric Roberts was, somewhat of a mainstream actor. And I just thought it was really interesting that he's going to play this scuzzy serial rapist murderer on the TV show Oz. That's incredibly dark and very, what am I trying to say here? It's a show that's off the beaten path that most people would have watched. It's very dark and intense, and I just love the fact that he was in it. My number three performance is Nature of the Beast.
Not seen.
Which was a film that came out in the mid-90s, early 90s with Lance Henriksen and Eric Roberts. And it's a road film where Lance Henriksen is traveling home. He's a traveling salesman. He's traveling across country, and he's trying to get home real fast. And he ends up meeting Eric Roberts along the way. He plays this mysterious drifter. And the story of the film is somebody robbed a casino for like a couple million dollars, and there's also a serial killer on the loose. And Eric Roberts and Lance Henriksen kind of pair up reluctantly with each other as they're traveling across Texas or New Mexico or wherever it takes place. And each place they stop, somebody gets murdered and stuff. And Eric Roberts just plays a very dark and sinister character. It's very good. It's a film that not most people have seen. The guy, what's his name, that did Powder and the Jeepers Creepers movies, Victor Da Silva.
Yeah, that,
I think is his name.
Yeah,
he directed
it. Arrested.
Yeah, he did. This was before all that happened.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
But yeah, that's a good film. My number two performance for Eric Roberts is Runaway Train. It's the film that he got nominated for with John Voight, where they play two inmates that escape a prison and they get on a train and something goes wrong with the train and it's essentially a runaway train and they're the only two on it. And for some reason, Rebecca De Mornay is on the train too. I think she was like a conductor that was sleeping or something like that. But Runaway Train gives you, that's the antithesis of the Eric Roberts overacting performance. I love it. He's just out of control in it. He plays so well off of John Voight, who is this dark, hardened inmate of the state. And it's a truly enjoyable film. It's hard to find. It went out of print. I don't know if Criterion or somebody's going to put it out, but I imagine it's going to get put out soon. And then my number one performance for Eric Roberts is, of course, Star 80. We gushed about it when we talked about the film. His absolute best performance by a mile. It's one of the best probably in my top 20 performances of all time. He's just, excuse me, he's just absolutely out of control. Love it. Love him in Star 80. I love Eric Roberts as an actor, even though his career has taken weird turns here and there. I always enjoy his performances. If I'm on Netflix or Amazon Prime late at night, and I see some straight-to-VOD Eric Roberts movie that came out, I'll probably put it on just to watch Eric Roberts because he always gives an enjoyable performance. I'd like to give some honorable mentions for Pope of Greenwich Village, Best of the Best 2, The Specialist, The Expendables, Inherent Vice, Gypsy Kings. The guy is in a lot of shit, and he's consistently busy with coming out with a bunch of movies, but when he's on, and I've always loved Eric Roberts, so I want to hear your top 10 so we can, or top 5 so we can argue about them. Kidding.
Well, number 5 was a direct match for you. I gave a tie for the cable guy for his cameo there, and then for more or less his cameo in The Dark Knight, which I will also say is what I remember. He has his legs broken in a rather painful manner.
Yep.
And I just will always remember how he's dropped in that film. My number 4, and it's a movie that I've only seen once, but it was something that I remember him in because he was memorable, was in Lansky, the HBO movie.
Oh, yeah.
That John McNaughton.
Plays Bugsy Siegel.
Yep, plays Bugsy Siegel. John McNaughton directed that one. David Mamet wrote the script and did a really nice job there. I remember watching that film when it aired on HBO, and I haven't seen it since, and I can still remember him in that one. My number 3 is a movie that's coming out on Blu-ray this summer, The Pope of Greenwich Village, which I had a chance to see a while ago, and I remember it pretty well. And the thing I can remember the most from it was the chemistry that he had with Mickey Rourke. I mean, you know, you get Mickey Rourke and Eric Roberts in the same movie and, you know, put him in some sort of like crime, you know, plot, and how could it go wrong?
Right.
It also had good comedy, as I recall. I'm really looking forward to seeing it again.
Yeah, that's going to be a good Shout Factory double feature, that and Desperate Hours.
Yep, which I have. Which I've never, yeah, and I've never seen that Desperate Hours, so that'll be good.
You'll enjoy it. It's good.
But yeah, Pope of Greenwich Village, good stuff. Number 2, I'm going to go with The Expendables because to me,
yes.
That sort of probably is an amalgam of all of these B action movie roles that he's. I mean, the guy has 100 credits on IMDb or 110 credits or something like that.
That's it.
Yeah, it's staggering. Does the guy sleep? I mean, it's like he's in everything. And
Go on his IMDb page and look at how much stuff is in production or filming right now.
I was just,
like, over 30 things.
You just took the words out of my mouth. What he has on tap for 2015 and 16, it's literally like the guy does not feel like sleeping. He's just going to go from one thing to the next. And you got to always commend somebody. These movies aren't A productions. These aren't huge things. The guy just wants to work. He wants to have fun. He wants to continue doing it. And, you know, when you hit that age and you've been doing it for this long, you don't have to do this stuff. He doesn't have to probably act if he doesn't want to. He wants to. And people want him in their movies because he brings something to it.
He's going to be in Human Centipede 3, which I think is really interesting. And I've seen the first two just to see him. And they're outrageous. And I thought the second one was really cool, a really cool way to make a sequel, especially to the Human Centipede. But I'm looking forward to the third one just for the sole fact that he's in it.
Yeah.
I kind of want to check that out.
I definitely did not see either the first two, so I'm not sure if I'm going to end up seeing this one to start, but it is...
You're not really missing much.
I don't think that I am, but I just thought he brought the, you know, Stallone wanted him to play the ultimate B-movie bad guy in The Expendables, and guess what? He was the ultimate B-movie bad guy in The Expendables.
Yeah, he's awesome in Expendables.
So I got to go with that number two. And then clearly number one by a long shot was Star 80. It was a performance that really just grabs you by the throat from the moment the movie starts. It doesn't let up. And it's just one of those performances you just don't – I just never saw that coming from an actor. I, you know, again, not growing up with him, you know, and being a little kid in the 80s and discovering these movies now. Just fearless performance, grabbed it by the balls. He ran with it. He wasn't afraid of getting nasty and looking ugly. And, you know, and that's when the best work always comes out, is when the actor is fearless and doesn't give a shit. And, you know, like you said, Bob Fosse didn't give no fucks with anything. He met the right actor for, you know, that lead performance, you know, a guy who clearly didn't care and was willing to leave it all out. So, yeah, that'd be my top five, for Eric Roberts. You want me to go into my Barkin and then we'll go into yours?
Do it to it, girl.
All right. Ellen Barkin obviously wasn't in Star 80, but we just kind of felt that she paired well with Eric Roberts, two 80s icons. So my number five, and there's going to be some runners up, which I'll run through at the end, but my number five is for her very small but very memorable cameo at the end of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is one of my absolute favorite movies of all time. It's a movie that I have watched, I couldn't even tell you how many times, and every time that her scene comes on, it's at the end of the movie after Del Toro and Johnny Depp have been on their ridiculous bender, and they're completely smashed still, and they're just not thinking straight, and she's this really depressed waitress working in this dingy diner, and she starts getting harassed by Benicio del Toro, and it's just, it's sad and it's kind of funny, but then it's definitely not funny. And she's just, there's this one scene with her and you see the 30 years on her face of working in that diner. And I just, it always just sticks out to me as this, it's the scene before the madcap finale of that film. And the way that Terry Gilliam shot the scene and the way that she was in it, I just thought she was perfect. Number four for me is going to be The Big Easy. Fantastic chemistry with Dennis Quaid, one of her, you know, first big roles to kind of blow her up, put her on the map. It's a good little fun movie. It wasn't exactly the movie that I thought I was getting into on a recent revisit, but I still had fun with it, and she was wonderful. My number three is a movie called Drop Dead Gorgeous, which you might kind of, you know, slap me around for, but I don't know if you've ever seen it. You ever see Drop Dead Gorgeous?
Fuck yeah, that's on my list too.
Okay, so Drop Dead Gorgeous. I've always thought that movie was hysterical. I know that it's not like a great movie, but it definitely was a precursor for these fake reality TV type, you know, movies and TV shows. This is the movie with Kirsten Dunst and the small town beauty pageant. And Ellen Barkin plays Kirsten Dunst's mother, an ex-beauty pageant queen who has all the tricks of the trade and wants her daughter to win at, you know, all costs. And
I just that she was really good in that one. Number two is This Boy's Life. Very dramatic, very intense performance from her as an abused wife to Robert De Niro's abusive husband and father to Leonardo DiCaprio's son. An impassioned performance. Michael Caton Jones made some very interesting movies there for a little while before he kind of fizzled out, and I think that was probably one of his best movies, if not his best film.
Yeah, that's a very good movie.
And there she was not asked to be the sex pot, the hottie, the femme fatale. She was just asked to basically just be, a mom or a wife, and
right.
I really like that performance. And number one for me, without a doubt, is Sea of Love, because it just, to me, it's the ultimate sum of her, in my opinion, of what she brought to movies. Sex appeal, humor, chemistry with her leading man, in this case, Pacino. The ultimate femme fatale, is she or is she not? I rewatched that one about 2 weeks ago, and I had forgotten just how much fun it was. They don't really make movies like that anymore.
That movie's so sexy.
It's super sexy. It's erotic. It's got good twists. When the finale comes, you buy it, enough. And I know that some people have some problems with the ending, but, I think that the movie works very well as a neo-noir and just a fun movie in general. And she's terrific in it. And I also want to throw out her really fun cameo in Tony Scott's The Fan as the lady on the radio station running the sports radio. I could totally just see Tony Scott and her getting along. I don't know what the relationship was as friends or whatnot. She just seems like the kind of lady that would jive with Tony. Also liked her a lot in Ocean's 13, a lot of fun there. Palindromes, she was also very good there too.
Yep, Todd Solondz.
Yep, Todd Solondz, I'm a huge fan of.
Same.
And here's one film that I haven't seen that I would like to see. Just based on this cast, Mad Dog Time from 19...
Right, Larry Bishop's movie? I want to see it too.
Gabriel Byrne, Richard Dreyfuss, Jeff Goldblum, Diane Lane, Burt Reynolds, and Kyle MacLachlan. If that's not enough of a reason to see a movie, I don't know what is. And I don't know anything about this movie. It has escaped me for all these years, and I got to track this one down. Mad Dog Time. So what do you got for Ellen Barkin?
My top five is Man Trouble. It's not that great of a movie, but it was Bob Ravelson and Nicholson's last film they did together. And I thought Ellen Barkin was fun in that movie, her and Nicholson playing off each other. It's just a fun combo to watch. I enjoyed that one. My number four is Drop Dead Gorgeous. She's just outrageous in that movie. I own that movie. I think that movie is hilarious. I love it. Number three is This Boy's Life. Loved her in that. You summed it up perfectly. It's just the battered wife, the good mother. She's great in that film. My number two is The Fan. I absolutely loved her in The Fan. I like that movie. I think that movie is
I love you for putting her at number two for The Fan.
Yeah, I think that movie's just grossly underrated, and I think she's just like the ultimate like cunt in that movie, and she's awesome though. She's the affable cunt. That's what she is in that movie, and I absolutely love her in that movie.
Yeah, she's a ball buster, and I really just could get the, I won't digress too much, but I had the chance to work with Tony Scott as a runner, a PA, and the sense of humor that I saw him exhibit. And again, I'm not like I ever met Ellen Barkin, but she just seems like the kind of person when I've seen her in interviews that really would have jived with Tony Scott's sensibility and his humor. And absolutely, I'm so pleased that you put that on there. That's great.
Yeah, and then my number one's obviously Sea of Love. Oh, my God, she's just so sexy. She's the ultimate femme fatale, or is she, in that movie. And that just the grocery store scene, I love it. And just the first time her and Pacino meet. And like that string of blind dates where Pacino's trying to find the femme fatale in the movie that's killing all these guys from meeting in personal ads. It's just like a great exchange. And she's just, I absolutely love her in that movie.
Yeah, the grocery store scene really was pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah, it's just, I love it. I just, anyway, we got to talk about that movie.
Absolutely.
That's got to be one of our movie of the weeks. So that's our top five for each of us. And I think it was pretty good. I think we pretty much covered. We had similar tastes this time. I dig it. For our top five list. So.
What have you gotten a chance to see during the week, just offhand or revisit or anything that you've picked up on Blu-ray? Any notables?
Yeah, man. You know me. I bought a stack of Blu-rays and one DVD combo. I bought Off Limits, Gordon's War. It was a Shout Factory 2-pack. I bought it for Off Limits, the film with Willem Dafoe, Gregory Hines, Fred Ward, and Scott Glenn. That's like the Night of the Generals remake, but takes place in Vietnam where these hookers are being killed, and Gregory Hines and Willem Dafoe are the MPs that are trying to find the colonel that's killing all the women. It's a masculine film. It's awesome. It's got a great cast. Love it. Bought King of the Hill on Criterion, which is what we'll be discussing next week. I haven't seen it yet, but I know you love it, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that. Got Miami Vice Inside Man Blu-ray 2-pack, Dark Blue on Blu-ray, Daredevil with Ben Affleck on Blu-ray. I know it's a shitty movie, but I've always enjoyed it. Battle of the Damned, Dolph Lundgren straight to DVD or straight to Blu-ray. Got Get Carter with Michael Caine Blu-ray, I Melt With You Blu-ray, and then I bought the Color of Night Playing God Blu-ray 2-pack for $5.
Which we have.
And anybody who's listening to this, it's $5 on Amazon.com, and you need to buy it because you need to watch the movie Color of Night.
And
I watched that twice this weekend. Yes, and we figured out that the unrated director's cut is the Blu-ray, even though in the back of the box it says it's R-rated. Paul Rowlands, Money and Delight, Nick and myself all figured out that this is the director's cut. So everybody, just buy it for $5. The movie's absurd, and it's obnoxious, and I just want to talk about this movie for an hour. We need to make a podcast about The Color of Night because this movie is just fucking the best way I could describe it is it's like this Hitchcockian Brian De Palma. It's like the shitty bastard half-breed kid of a Brian De Palma Hitchcockian movie. That's exactly what it is. It's just this movie, it's out of control.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty and to make it even more interesting, Richard Rush's director's cut was R-rated. As far as I know, and my guess is that if I'm wrong, somebody will point it out. As far as I'm aware, the director's cut of there was a theatrical cut that was rated R, and Richard Rush was not happy with it. He then was able, after letting go of the film for the theatrical version, he was then able to put a director's cut together, which was then screened for the MPAA, and who still gave the film an R despite their typically staunch opposal to shots of dongs. And this is the famous Bruce Willis, just the tip in the pool. And
the sex scenes are so obnoxious.
Yeah, they're
and
so
gratuitous.
Erotic and sleazy and just you know, Jane Marsh, you know, in the early mid 90s. I mean, you
oh,
know,
God.
I mean, not much else, you know, come on.
I just, on my second rewatch, I took a picture of Bruce Willis's tip on my TV and I sent it to you.
Yes,
and you're like, what's that?
That
and then
lovely.
I'm like, dude, it's Willis's tip. And then I sent it to Paul and Paul's just like, what is that? And I'm like, it's Willis's tip. And
yeah.
He's just like, geez, man. thought it was awesome. I just want to send that to people. It's just so obnoxious.
It is. It's an you know, it's a movie that doesn't even work really in the it's just such a ludicrous movie. As in the director's cut form, it doesn't even really work. It's just so asinine. It's
no.
over the top. You know that the killer from the beginning.
Yes.
But having said that, there's watchable, there's bad movies that are watchable, and then there are bad movies that are unwatchable, and this one.
And then there's movies that are The Color of Night.
Are you kidding
you
me with,
love.
like Leslie Ann Warren's performance in that movie? Like,
Leslie Ann Warren's shitty in everything, and she's perfectly shitty in this movie.
It's so, you know, we got to do a Richard Rush where we talk about Freebie and the Bean, The Stuntman, Color of Night. I got to watch Getting Straight. There's a few.
That's
more.
Fine, but we need to spend like a podcast on
spend some time
just specifically on Color of Night. Because I just knew when I was watching it, because you and Paul and Wayne Kramer and all these guys were talking about it, and I was like, I'm just gonna fucking buy it. It's $5, and plus I get the Duchovny Playing with God. Seriously, like this movie's become like my new obsession.
Yeah, listen, I get easily obsessed with something like, you know, with something fun and crazy. So absolutely. Anything else that you picked up or notable revisits for the week or?
No, not really. I watched Color of Night 2 or 3 times. I watched Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, which I always liked. I always enjoyed
that. Oh, yeah, me too. The first 10 minutes of that movie are just, they're fucking awesome. I mean, there's just no other way
right.
to put it. Like, the first 10 minutes of that movie is just, it's the zombie movie for me. That's one of the zombie movies for people who don't love zombie movies, if you will.
Right. The whole zombie thing, like, I'm not into Walking Dead
at
all.
Neither am I.
I'm not into the zombie fad. Like, I love the Romero films, and I like the Zack Snyder movie.
Me too.
That's as far as I go with zombies.
It has more to do with Zack Snyder's aesthetic and his visual style than anything else.
Exactly.
Me,
but, that's why I love it so much.
Yeah. Good stuff. I was able to mix in some stuff last week, some revisits of some older things and a couple of new things. Really enjoyed, and I saw it on DVD, and there is a Blu-ray, I believe, in the works coming out at some point soon for Who'll Stop the Rain, Carl Reese's film from 1978 with Nick Nolte.
Yeah, Twilight Time's going to put it out.
Okay.
That's when I'm going to get it.
Yeah. Just a fantastic film that would just never get made in this day and age. I mean, it's a chase movie, it's a romance, it's an anti-war, it's an action picture that kicks ass, it's a drug and addiction drama. It was just, again, being a child of the 80s and, you know, some of these movies flying over my head and never getting into them, just really impressed on every level with it. I want to see it again. Nick Nolte in his first real dramatic role. This is right after he did The Deep, and this is not The Deep. The Deep is, you know, a fun sort of just kitschy, crappy kind of thing. I mean, it is what it is. It's fun, but it's not Who'll Stop the Rain, and I think that just people had to have been impressed with Nolte, and if it didn't happen right away, then it certainly would happen later on in his career, but just a really good film. Another one from the early 90s, which I finally caught up with, and, you know, really saw for the first time, if you will, was Rush, which was directed by Lily Finney Zanuck. It's just unbelievable to think that she would have only directed one movie and it would have been something that was that good. Great undercover cop movie, Jason Patrick and Jennifer Jason Leigh. It's all about these two cops.
Greg Allman, love it.
Yeah, Greg Allman is the bad guy, just quietly menacing, doesn't say much, and is just so nasty. Powerhouse of an ending, just a fantastic ending to that movie. I really enjoyed it a lot. It was a film that I had saw a long time ago. I had no memory of it. And it makes the casting of Jason Patrick in Narc even more inspired. It sort of feels like a continuation of sorts of that theme and that character. And, just despite both films having nothing to do with one another, I just couldn't help but feel that, you know, Carnahan really, he knew what he was doing there by casting Jason Patrick. Also had a chance to watch a movie that I think is just so stylish, and I just can't, I know that it's not my favorite movie, and I know that it's not perfect, but a movie that came out in the late 90s called In Dreams, which is not on Blu-ray yet, and when it does come out on Blu-ray, it will look absolutely gorgeous. This is a Neil Jordan serial killer thriller, which is just one shot after another of Darius Kanji gorgeousness. The opening of that movie is still one of the most visually arresting things that I have seen in any movie. I know, I think we talked about this one. This one escaped you. You haven't seen this one in Dreams?
No, I love Neil Jordan, and I just didn't care for in Dreams. I hadn't seen it for a while. It's probably been like 10 years since I've seen it. It's all revisited.
It's worth a revisit.
Due to your write-up.
It's cool.
I just didn't dig it.
It's a weird movie. It's got an interesting tone. It's kind of a hyperventilating movie, and that bending is very wired in it.
I don't even know what that means, but now I want to rewatch it because it's a hyperventilating movie.
Well,
that's awesome.
There's just a lot of scenes of very frantic emotions, and people are sort of high strung, and you know, she's not mentally fit in that film, and Robert Downey Jr. Gives this sort of really weird performance as you know, the maybe killer. It's just a really weird film, and but just visually, I'm so enamored when a filmmaker has a distinct vision for something, and they just grab you right away. And the opening of that film is so cool. They show you how a town is turned into a dam. I don't know if you remember it, but you watch the flooding of this small New England town, and it's just so creepy and unique and weird. And I've never seen something like that. And it's always one of those movies that it's not my favorite movie, but it's always stuck out in my head as this film that just was just weird and cool in a way that not many other movies are. And I'm just trying to think about what else. I mean, that's kind of it. There's a lot of Blu-rays coming out over the next few weeks, which is exciting. Got Inherent Vice coming out this week, which is going to be great. A great rewatch there. Very excited about that.
Yeah, I'm just going to buy that.
Yep.
I built up some PayPal money in my PayPal account, and I'm going to buy a region-free Blu-ray player, and then my life's going to be just fucking over. Because I know you just got a region-free Blu-ray player, and I'm going to hit Amazon UK hard.
Yeah, that was how I was going to sort of close it out, is that I finally...
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. Finally pulled the trigger and got the region-free player. I haven't set it up yet. But the first batch of UK Amazon purchases are on their way across the pond, and I'm very anxious to check those out, you know, get into the whole purchasing of movies that for some reason refuse to be released here.
That's so fucked up how that happens. I just don't understand the whole region thing. I don't get it.
Never understood it myself. I don't quite understand why you would make a movie like Strange Days available in Germany only or something when there's plenty of people in America who would spend $20 on it. It's never made any sense to me.
Look what our lives have come to. We're buying region-free Blu-ray players so we can buy movies that are only released on Blu-ray in Europe.
Exactly.
Because for some reason they're not here.
Exactly.
Thanks society. It's all Obama's fault.
Thanks, Fox. But yeah, no, very excited to increase the collection even more. And yes, as you said, Amazon UK is going to be the end of me. So I'll just leave it at that for the moment.
Right. Well, to close things out, I just finished my first draft on my novella or novel. I don't know what it is yet, but I let Nick read it, and you gave me some valuable feedback. I've let a few other people read it. Gary Young has read some of it, and he gave me tremendous feedback. So just, dear listeners, I'm going to be pumping this thing once I actually get it published, which I hope to by... summer, midsummer sometime. That would be excellent, because then I could give it to my friend as a wedding gift who's getting married at the end of August. How perfect of a wedding gift would that be?
Yes, and having read it, it should definitely be a final remembrance of what it is like to not be married.
There you go.
And I would definitely say that it was a lot of fun to read, and I am looking forward to reading the final version, however you do decide to finish it out after our conversations. But it was entertaining, and it reminded me, like I said, of Hunter Thompson at times, and obviously the influence of Bukowski is all over it, and it's definitely one of those slices of life that I think that a lot of people will be able to relate to. So,
I appreciate it. And you wrote up an excellent synopsis for me, which was perfect. And I could never have written something like that for it. And I really appreciate it. That was most excellent of you.
My pleasure. It'll be fun. When it's published, it'll be fun to see it on the back of the book. Very cool. So, and next week we're going to dip into, in my opinion, one of easily Steven Soderbergh's most underrated movie outside of some of the more esoteric, small experimental movies that he did, like Bubble and Girlfriend Experience. But we're going to be looking at Steven Soderbergh's King of the Hill, which is a Depression era set drama that not many people have seen. When you say King of the Hill, everybody thinks of the Fox TV show. Nobody thinks of the Steven Soderbergh movie. And in my opinion, that should be changed. This is an excellent movie. I highly recommend to people to check it out if you are interested in quality filmmaking and good storytelling, and watching a film that honestly just snuck by way too many people, and we'll get into that next week. So King of the Hill, and then our top five actors and actresses are going to be unrelated to the movie of discussion. We're going to go with two of my favorite current actors, Sam Rockwell and Keira Knightley. So we'll have some good stuff to talk about between all of their work. So other than that, I think we're good, right?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you, everybody who's listening and giving us feedback. Much appreciated. We ran a little long this time, but I mean, fuck it.
Yeah.
You only live once, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're Don Draper, you live twice. We forgot to talk about last week's episode, which is cool. We'll save it. We'll save the Mad Men talk for when that show's over.
Yeah, I was going to even say to you, why don't we talk a little bit about Mad Men next week, maybe at the front end, but maybe you're right. Maybe we save our Mad Men talk for another month just because we only do have four episodes left, and the ending of that show feels like it will be seismic. In a way, I still think that it's going to go out smooth.
It has to.
This isn't a show like Breaking Bad or The Sopranos or one of these other things where you're building to a violent confrontation or some sort of plot mechanism. This is going to be a show that's going to end, I feel like, the best episodes of the show has ever ended on a smooth note. We'll see. Very curious to see how it ends. So yeah, we'll definitely put some time into Mad Men, and we should probably spend some time on some of the other really quality TV shows that are out there right now, because as many people say, and it's very true, the television over the last 5, 6, 7 years has become equal to, if not better than, some movies. So
I agree.
But yes, thank you guys very much for listening. Appreciate all the feedback and the support. It's always a lot of fun.
Thanks, guys. Catch you next week.